Hi, everyone, and welcome to Focus Forward, an executive function podcast where we explore the challenges and celebrate the wins you'll experience as you change your life through working on improving your executive function skills. I'm your host, Hannah Choi. All right, so this week we're talking about one of the most powerful tools we have out there for our focus, our mental health, our community, our families, our children, ourselves. It's music. We don't even realize how much music plays a role in our lives. And luckily, gone are the days of believing we must work in sterile, silent environments. Many, or dare I say most, brains, including those with ADHD and other EF challenges, truly benefit from some kind of stimulation while doing focused work. The power of music has been studied by researchers, so if you'd like to learn more, I've shared some articles in the show notes. But one of the best resources I can recommend is a brand new book out called Resonant Minds. It was written by a daughter and father pair, Sarah and Mort Sharman, and this book covers all aspects of music, from its impact on the brain and learning, including as a mindfulness practice, or as Sarah and Mort call it, mindful action, to its positive impact on individuals and community. I sat down with Sarah and Mort to learn more about music and share stories about how music has impacted us and others, and about, as Sarah and Mort say, that music is ultimately about love. Sarah and Mort are so uniquely qualified to write this book that I asked them to introduce themselves, and the book, Resonant Minds, is such a unique book that I knew it was only right for them to describe it. So let's get on with the show. Hey, Sarah and Mort, thank you so much for joining me on Focus Forward. I am so excited to learn about the work that you guys do. Sarah, could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, so my name is Sarah Sherman. I am the director and founder of the interactive children's concert series, Mozart for Munchkins. I started as a pianist, and then we have this concert series that brings interactive musical experience to children and their families, but also to schools, assemblies, and professional development days based in New York City.
Great. And Mort.
Hi, hello, everybody. I am Mort Sharman. I'm a retired, although we call it repurposed, the superintendent of schools, and I was the senior associate executive director of ASA, the Superintendents Association for the United States. And most importantly, I am Sarah's father, co-author, and really very honored to talk with you, Hannah, and to be the co-author with Sarah of an important piece of work which has shaped our lives during my entire career. And I want to thank Sarah. I'm not sure that I do this often enough, but she has been a great teacher of ours about life and music.
I love that. Sarah, will you tell me about the book, Resonant Minds? I loved it.
Thank you. At its core, Resonant Minds is a book about love. And I say that because it's a book about finding presence within ourselves through something that is at our fingertips every day, how we can intentionally use music as a tool for focus, for connection, community building, executive functions, cognitive learning, leadership. The list really goes on. And so the book goes through all of these in detail with anecdotes, interviews with neuroscientists, great thought leaders, and it has QR codes throughout. So if we're talking about a piece of music and how you might be able to intentionally use this in your everyday life, you can actually listen to it in real time as you're reading along the with the book.
That's really cool. Mort, do you want to share anything about your experience with the book?
Yeah, you know, yesterday happened to be that I was in the front in the driveway working on some flower beds. And one of the neighbors who heard a local presentation that Sarah and I did, where we did here in Virginia, stopped and said, "I can't stop thinking about your book and about your presentation." And I said, "So what is there particularly that you're thinking about?" And he said, "This concept of groove just is so interesting to me. I don't get it entirely." And we talked a little bit, and he said, "I understand standing at a concert and swaying." He said, "But there's so much more to that, isn't there?" And we talked about engaging and connecting and networking with others in a mindful way, not mindfulness, but through mindful action. So what evolved in this book, which Sarah and I describe as a book about love, is this concept of how do we use music as one of the most natural, most ubiquitous forms of connection that we have as humans, but often it's that silence in the background or the noise in the background or just something we listen to but don't pay a lot of attention to it. And it's potential, and Sarah's so much better at this than I about talking about the science behind it. But the connection that we could have for ourselves and with others is so profound. And so the book for us is this way of elevating and bringing people together around music and helping and supporting one another as humans.
Tell us the story of why we're having this conversation, how we got to here.
So I don't think we can talk about how Resonant Minds came to be without talking about the way I grew up with music in my life. So I've always been surrounded by music. My parents, from a young age, I was fell asleep to a transistor radio. We sang in our household. My father and I would listen to Ode to Joy, and instead of singing the words, make animal noises instead of the German. And music always was something that was enjoyable and something that was to be experienced, not just passively listened to. When my daughter was born in 2017, I was still performing as a concert pianist. So through all of that, I grew up playing the piano. I got to perform in beautiful concert halls throughout the world. I went to Manhattan School of Music. And I was performing regularly. And when my daughter was 4 months old, she came to a concert with the Chelsea Symphony where I was playing Shostakovich Piano Concerto, which is this big, serious kind of raucous piece. And I invited a lot of new parent friends because it's a big deal to be a soloist with orchestra in front of everybody. And a lot of them said they were going to come, but they didn't show up. And I was really disappointed. And I started to ask, well, why? Eva was there, my daughter, in a little snuggie. My husband was wearing her. I said, well, what if my baby needed to cry, if they needed a diaper change, if they needed to eat? And I understood, but at the same time, it was eye-opening to see that there was a really big gap in New York City, where I'm based, to have children of all ages, babies, infants, toddlers, kids, experience high caliber music, and allow kids to be kids. And so I founded Mozart for Munchkins in December of 2017, which is an interactive concert series. And we started with one concert and then two concerts and three concerts because there was this need and this want for this type of experience. And then fast forward a few years, and also my father and my mother came up for the very first performance and held my daughter as I played Flight of the Bumblebee, and they buzzed her around in the air like she was a bee. And I started to do some work with Mind Up, the Goldie Hawn Foundation, and using music as this vehicle for mindfulness. And when I started doing professional development days, I kept calling my father and saying, "What about this? What about that? Is this an okay idea? How are we using music and merging mindful action along with this?" And he kept saying, "You're writing your book. You're writing your book." And I'd say, "No, I'm not writing it without you." And so now take us a few years later, and it's been a joy and a pleasure to work on this, work together to use education and music and mindful action and to really merge it into what we believe Resonant Minds is more than just a book, it's a community.
Don't forget to check out our MAP program and community. We offer daily interactive live sessions for planning and accountability, work sprints for virtual co-working guided by an executive function expert, weekly skill building workshops to learn more about executive function skills and different tools and strategies, and an online community to share ideas, ask for help, and connect with others. We offer a 14-day free trial for anyone who'd like to try it out. You can visit our website at map.worksmartcoaching.com or shoot me an email at podcast@beyondbooksmart.com and I can help you out. As one of our mappers said, MAP has been a game changer for me. I'm getting so much more done. The morning sessions help me slow down, get clear on my priorities, and actually make a plan for the day. While the work sprints have been super motivating and have helped me finally get through tasks that I've been avoiding, the interactive slides and getting feedback from the MAP community are such a highlight of the morning sessions. So I hope you join us. So Mort, how did you know from early on? Is this something that comes from within you, or did you make a conscious decision to raise your children in that kind of musical environment?
We were not classically trained. We didn't have a musical family, either mine or my wife's. We always had this, what we call in a book, this musical spark. Something ignited within us that made us love music. But there's a reciprocal nature of music that we talk about in the book in a number of ways. But as a father-daughter, Sarah taught us about music. You know, we used to play classical music, even in utero. You know, my wife played classical music all the time to the kids. And when they grew up, we played Bette Midler and ran around the house with all kinds of bawdy songs that Bette Midler sang. And I always had it as part of my heart. Sarah taught me how to use my heart and mind with music. As a superintendent of schools for 25 years in a number of different districts and as a principal, music was always part of what I did, from silliness, including having programs where I'd hand out hundreds of kazoos. And we'll go back to the example Sarah gave before. Do you know what it's like to have 200 or 300 teachers play Ode to Joy on kazoos? Or You Are My Sunshine in a Rotary Club with kazoos? Those are the things I did. And I never quite understood why I was doing them, except that I could see in the faces of the folks with whom I was working that it was bringing some joy, that they were engaged deeply. And it made me feel great as well. And until Sarah started poking really hard about why we do this, how we do this, how can we do it better in the work she did with Mozart for Munchkins, I never thought deeply about the impact on the brain and the heart and the rhythm and a groove that goes with it. So she was my best teacher through all this. And parenting for us was always very deliberate, intentional. It's not as if we said, go ahead, raise yourself, go play in the streets, and come home in time for dinner. We were intentional about what we did. Music was part of it, but again, we never knew quite why. And so, as I left the superintendencies and had the good fortune to work with superintendents across the country, music continued to be part of what I did. I remember starting programs where I'd ask the participants, whether it was an urban academy that I was creating or an aspiring principals program I was running, I'd ask, well, we started with introductions like you're doing here, Hannah, put in the chat your favorite song and we'll create a playlist for this academy. And so that thread has always been there. And I never ever forget to thank Sarah for bringing into light and to life the music that was always part of my life now in a much more meaningful way.
So you mentioned the brain, and I just love talking about the brain. So can we talk about that for a little bit and how closely connected music is to the brain and the impact that it has on the brain? And maybe we can also, I mean, Sarah, I'm sure you'd love to talk about mindfulness too, because that's so such a part of it. And I really loved how in your book you talked about that connection and how the different ways that music can help create mindfulness for people. So, could we talk about that for a little while?
Yes, which one to start with?
I know.
Music and the brain overall, I'll just start because I
Yeah.
find this fascinating that there is no such thing really as background music because our neurons start going off 300 to 500 milliseconds after we're exposed to music. That's faster than we have a conscious thought. It's about the same speed in which we blink our eyes. And so it goes through our auditory cortex, our amygdala is starting to fire. So you have the opportunity, and you at large people, me, you, anyone, to select a song to help shift our mental state because it's going to do that when we're exposed to music, whether we realize it or not. And so that's the core of the book is let's put intention behind this and how can we use music that is already impacting our brain before we even realize it to help us in our everyday lives? So there are so many other facets that we can go in the direction of the brain, but that's really the why of what we do is because there's this tool that's available to us. The average American, 70% of Americans already listen to music 3 to 4 hours a day. And you mentioned mindfulness, and I won't go too much into that. But on the flip side, 14% of adults practice or have practiced some type of mindfulness or meditative behavior. And while we're very clear that we use the word mindful action and not mindfulness. That's still a really important idea to be aware of, because mindful action is this purposeful way that we use music to bring presence to ourselves and to bring this heightened awareness. And so if there's 14% of people that are doing that on a daily basis, but over 70% of us are listening to music, whether we realize it or not, how can we use this together? And so that's why we use the word mindful action and with music as this lever and a tool for it. I can go into other parts of, our default mode network and focus and things like that. I don't know if you have specific questions or ways that
Yeah, I
from here
think it's
to go.
really important to talk about that. I mean, so one thing that we talk about with our clients is, and when we're educating people about executive function skills and about motivation and about attention, is how music can be used, like you said, as a tool. And we have observed that in the past, there was this idea that you had to be in this really sterile environment in order to really focus. But now we know that it actually does help to keep the, it helps you with focus to keep the brain, the default mode network, that dopamine, all the things a little bit entertained, right? So then you can find your focus. Could you go a little bit into that?
Yeah, so there's two ways I want to go into that. The first one is I'll talk about the default mode first. And so there's two ways that we talk about in the book, this active listening and purposeful passive listening. And the active listening we talk about for focus, the more that we practice something like actively listening, the better we are in our everyday lives, whether it's a conversation for our parents listening, having your child listen to you, or even listening to our children, because sometimes that's hard. We, as parents, we often think we know what's right, and maybe we need to listen a little bit better. So the way we sometimes suggest that with music is whether it's listening to the lyrics, listening to a melody in particular. We really like doing this breathing with Bach, which is measuring your breath so it goes along with the beat, which is a form of active listening. The other side, this purposeful passive listening, is not actively trying to pick something out of the music, but it's what you were saying with this focus element. It's finding music that helps activate our default mode network so that we can focus on emails or on writing or reading, whatever it might be, and that we find music with low beats per minute that does not have lyrics. Lyrics tend to be invasive. Again, that could be great for active listening, but not for something that we necessarily want to activate our default mode network. That it supports us when we're, with our default mode network, when we're our most creative, our problem solving, and that music can be this guide. Also, we find that when we talk a lot about feedback loops of the familiar, and I'll have my dad go on that, but that if we repeat a song and attach a behavior to it. So whether we use this same song, whether it's, let's say, Debussy Clair de Lune, a lot of people know that song. I have a hard time focusing to that because I play it on the piano, so I get distracted and my fingers start going along, but that's me. But I know for some people, it's a great way to sit down and do their emails. And if you attach a task, say, that's a song I'm going to play, and that means I need to sit down and get to work. If we have that repetitive behavior with it enough times, like when we brush our teeth, and then eventually it becomes we teach a kid to brush their teeth and they're learning how to do it or ride a bike. It's a conscious effort and behavior. And then out of the sudden, it goes into our subconscious and it's automatic. So it goes for our explicit memory to our implicit memory, and it has this response, and then it releases dopamine. And we can use music in that same way and that same cue. And it doesn't just have to be the default mode network. It can be a cue to get out the door if there's something that you struggle with in your everyday life, whether it's just waking up. And if you have the same, hey, let's get motivated for the day song, then when we attach it enough and that dopamine release, we can come back and we start to have this automatic response again because your neurons are firing too before you even recognize what's happening when you listen to music. So that cue is something that we can build into our everyday lives.
I had a funny experience where that happened. So I really like to listen to I really like K-pop, and I have found that music in another language that I don't understand is great for me to listen to when I'm working because my brain doesn't listen to the lyrics because I don't know what they're saying anyway. So I was working on this big project, and then I and I was listening to this one specific artist. And then I got to see him in concert. And I said to my husband, I'm like, why do I keep thinking about work? I can't. I'm like kind of not enjoying myself at this concert because I keep thinking about work and I couldn't figure out why. And then I was like, oh, wait, it's because I was listening to this music on repeat while I was doing that work project.
I want to pick up on this idea that you're both getting to is the default network, the default approach. And we're playing with this blog that I'm writing. It came out of a conversation with Sarah just last night. It has to do with Shake It Off, Taylor Swift, with Shake and Versus, or coupled with Shake Your Mind. And I'll reduce all the brain language that Sarah's so terrific about talking about into dad language. And so this idea of shaking it off, Taylor Swift, I guess, had received some bad reviews in 2014 or something. And it's a great song, and it's half of the formula. The other half is what you two are talking about. How do you shake your mind? How do you engage your mind, activate the mind deliberately? It goes back to your question, Hannah, from before. Like, what about our family? What started the music? Somewhere there was a mindful spark. What our position is in the book is that you can create intentionally, deliberately, purposefully, those moments of the mental spark, the musical spark, which puts you into the shaking of your mind, that cognitive process where you are deliberately using the executive functions, where you're deliberately using those parts of your brain, and I would add the heart, which lead you to being better for yourself and better with others. And to me, this idea, the story you just told me about going to the concert and referring back constantly to work, well, I think it's probably a loose analogy for us, but Sarah just mentioned the concept of the feedback of the familiar, that we're so regulated to play our list, to go to the commercial playlist. And their only purpose is to get you to buy their list. It's like going shopping online. They tell you what you bought last time, what you're going to like next time. And we're saying, shake your mind. Stop doing that. Break that feedback loop of the familiar. It's listening, it's trusting. And then moving beyond the familiar. I think those are cognitive processes that only music could give you.
Yeah, I agree. And thinking about the all the executive function skills that are involved with that, and it's the most important one, I think, or one of the most important ones is that cognitive flexibility, right? Being able to think outside the box and to challenge your brain to try something new. And music is such a great opportunity for that. I love how I think you talked about how you I can't remember if I read this in the book, if I heard you on a podcast talking about this, Sarah, but how you within your family, you each pick a new song for everyone to listen to, and your son was doing fart song. Fart song. Is he still playing the fart song? We're out of
This is
we're
her son, my grandson.
we're actually. It's really funny. Is so I will talk about that, but. And speaking of really listening to our children or to other people, I played an excerpt of that podcast for my son, thinking like, oh, I talked about my kids. They'd be so excited to hear about it. And when he heard me talk about the William Tell Overture, which, the William Tell Overture, well-known classical music piece, they have it available in a fart version, which is ridiculous. But at the same time, as a proud parent, he's asking for William Tell, just not the way I would want it. He was so upset. He said, take it back, take it back. But so in terms of hearing, I heard what my son said at that moment, and I tried explaining, what I love about him selecting that is that we listen to each other's music, and where that's not my choice, I respect that you like listening to fart songs and then you listen to my music at the same time. And so I think that's really special. And that's what I was trying to say. So we had a conversation about that. But that's essentially what it is in our my family of four, not extended family too, but on a weekly basis, we listen to a lot of music every single day. And we do have music. They're my children, so they're my guinea pigs. And we do have music that's a queue in our household, but we also take turns, car rides, dinner time, dancing it off before bed. And we each pick a song. And sometimes my son in particular, if he really doesn't like a song, he makes up his own words to it.
Yeah.
And they're not a he do you know the Minions movies?
Yes.
So he speaks in Minionese instead of actually singing the words. It drives
Nice.
my daughters nuts and my daughter nuts. But at the same time, he's also singing along the melody. So there's something sweet about that. But we don't always do it perfectly. And I think that's something about this flexibility that you talk about. And especially what I'm trying to help show my children is this flexibility. Hey, you don't like this song. We hear you're singing it in Minionese. It's really pissing off your sister. Let's try to, you get next choice. And so we really just try to allow each other to have a voice. And because of that, my children do listen to everything from fart songs to Taylor Swift. They ask for Bach cello suites when they need a break or a reset. And they have a really wide range of music that they listen to on a regular basis. And they also know what to select for their moods. They know when I'm in a bad mood, speaking of Taylor Swift, my daughter comes up to me and says, "Let's play Shake It Off and Dance It Out," or "Let's play Shut Up and Dance With Me." And it's hard to stay cranky or moody, whatever is going on in my brain, when my own daughter is taking my hands and trying to use music as this cue to get me
She
out of it.
knows the power of it. So, okay, so like, can we keep talking about kids?
Wait,
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Hannah, wait, just I want to this example, this piece of the conversation is so important. I want to tell you a couple of very fast stories. One, not everybody is classically trained. Sarah's played classical music around the world. She's also in a klezmer band. She has played jazz. She has an amazing
I
repertoire
badly
of
play
music in her
jazz.
fingertips. But you have it in your head, in your fingers. You don't have to be classically trained. You don't have to have this vast repertoire of music at your fingertips or in your head. That just play with, open your mind, that question of shaking your mind a little bit and understanding intentionally you can use music for conversation without saying a word. And the third story I want to tell you is this whole idea of moving beyond, whether it's Sarah at home, but understanding other music. Our family is broad and vast and has lots of different interests. My son-in-law here in Virginia loves country music, and I told her I'm now beyond the gag level of listening to country music. There's beautiful ballads, there's beautiful stories in there that had it not been for him, I would have never listened to. In the same token, he listens to classical music and goes to plays with us that he would never have done had he not been with us. And the story goes on with family member after family member. And one quick story is this idea of listening and trusting not just to your own children and your own four and your family, but our grandson loves indie music because he's rejected country, he's rejected classical, he's rejected the oldies of his mother, and he listens to independent music. And we, all of a sudden, as grandparents, because we love and trust him, are listening to in his independent music because it calms him. And so I think the extension of Sarah's point is absolutely on target, is to love and respect and hear the voices of others so that you could become a larger network and community through music.
I love that. And it is so vulnerable. I feel like it can feel very vulnerable to share your music with other people because it does, you associate it so much with part of, or many people associate it so much with part of your identity, like who you are. This music is who I am. So sharing it and saying, this is part of me and I'm sharing it with you. If that can be really scary. So you need to know that the people that you're sharing it with are going to be open and flexible and willing to listen.
I think one of the things that's really interesting about that is that when we listen to music together, there's two different ways I want to talk about that. But that first one, kind of when we're talking more on this, respecting each other's musical choices and how it can be vulnerable, is that when we listen to music together, it releases oxytocin. And so we feel this bond. And if we think about being connected with people, we all know that oxytocin is really important in that. And so, whether it is a group of friends or even a group of people in a concert, you feel that kinship when you're like, hey, we like this music together and we're in it together. And all of a sudden, this bond is formed with strangers because of listening to music. And so, I think again, it's one of those ways in which I think music is often underutilized in building this community with oxytocin as this tool. If we think of this brain chemical as a tool we can use for more connectivity, especially in today's world when we're in a loneliness epidemic, that music is here for us to connect all of us, even for when we don't have the words on how to express what we're feeling. Music is there, and a song can express how we're feeling sometimes better than words can for somebody that's not comfortable using language. On the other side of that, my father mentioned groove before. And groove isn't just like dancing at a party or a thing like that. Groove, at this neurological term, is when we listen to music that's usually 80 to 120 beats per minute, our brainwaves actually synchronize. There's this neural entrainment that happens. And so not only are you listening to music collectively, and 80 to 120 beats per minute is important because it's innate inside all of us. That's the tempo most of us walk to. And so it already is this beat that's inside of all of us. And then our brainwaves synchronize with the people we're in a room. So beyond that oxytocin release, which can happen with any type of music, whether it's that beats per minute or not, this groove that's happening is creating the sense of community. Think about a drum circle. Think about that K-pop concert. I bet you those K-pop songs fell into this. And so when we also have that, it releases endorphins and it makes us feel good and it makes us feel happy. So again, this whole sense of community is really important. And this then using music in that and recognizing ways in which we can bring that into our everyday lives is something that I think we're just really starting to understand as neuro arts is being, is this movement that's coming out of Johns Hopkins isn't really important, so that the scientists aren't here and the artist practitioners, there's a lot more merging of the fields going on, which I think is wonderful to put the why behind what we already often do.
Well, Sarah had a conversation with her brother-in-law, Matt, our son-in-law, who is this country listener and a baseball fanatic. When he refers to the Commanders or to any local team, he always uses the pronoun we. And I said, great, you bought part of the team. Financial security, I'm not worried anymore. But we had an amazing conversation exactly about your point, Hannah. He said, when I'm at a ball game, I'm with others, I feel connected. And when I'm at a concert, I feel the same way. He said, what I don't necessarily feel is when I leave, that community dissipates, that family, that whatever it is, that social connection. And so what Sarah and I want to create is this idea of creating networks that sustains beyond that church experience or concert experience or ballgame experience, that we can create this movement of people who contribute their playlists, their songs, their thinking about life, in a way which is not once and done. Oh, I feel really good. Dopamine's out there. Right. Let me go home now and cook supper.
Yeah. Right. Well, I think your book is a really wonderful place that you're doing that. I mean, that you, within the book, you are sharing music and you are sharing, I don't know that I'm not sure what word to say. I want to say, like, you're sharing, it's more than just music. You're creating space. You're creating these spaces out of, you know, out of the music. And yeah. What was I just saying, Sarah? Like, no, I can't say what I mean, but hopefully.
But no, because I'm going to put Sarah on the spot, Hannah, because you just did what Sarah did to me for 6 months and 9 months of writing. Which is we became this, we went to the word kaleidoscope, pulling together different theories, different approaches to create a theory that we don't think exists out there in a uniform way. And we wanted to create a book which wasn't dust or cyber real dust and sits on a shelf somewhere, but really does create the network in the community and brings people into the music. Yeah. And Sarah, you ready? I gave you enough time here to get ready for the question that Hannah said to, what is our book about? Really, when you come to the essence of it, Hannah, I think what you're asking is like when we combine the personal stories, the research, the outside authors, the anecdotes, it's all about, Sarah?
Love.
Yes. So, yeah. I loved that part. Yeah. I actually got a little teary when I read that part. It's so true. Yeah.
I do want to go back to one thing I wanted to say earlier when you were talking about the concerts, because I think I did a disservice when we were talking about cues earlier, and not mentioning the way in which our brains already react to cues and then memories and spirituality. And so if you already think of a song that has been sung to you for generations or something, even something as simple as let's say da-dum, ba-dum. What song is that? You know within two notes what it is. And so that music has this ability beyond recognizing a movie or da-da-da-dum, ba-da-da-dum. We associate with that and recognize it, but it has the power to evoke smells or memories of baking cookies on a holiday or whatever it might be. And so the way in which our brain attaches to music is different than other memories. And we find that a lot with Alzheimer's patients. And that a lot of times, because it's a different part of our brain that is activated, or it's the full brain. When we listen to music, the whole brain is lit up in a way that nothing else, you know, language is dedicated to a certain part of the brain and problem solving over here. But music is everywhere. And so we often find that an Alzheimer's patient might not remember a name of a loved one, but they could sit down and play a song, or they know all the lyrics to something that they grew up singing. And I think that alone as an image is so powerful on the impact of music for our brains and how then let's use it now so that when maybe when we're going through Alzheimer's later in our lives, we can bring back these memories that found us peace and they found brought us
Yeah,
joy.
I really want to talk about kids, and brain development and music education. I guess it's a little personal because my kids have both played instruments. My son plays the violin and the piano, and my daughter plays the cello. And they're both very, very good, and they're both very dedicated musicians. And they belong to a youth orchestra, and I get so emotional at every concert because I feel the energy in the room and I see these hundreds of kids up there playing this like mind-blowingly good music, and you know they're just so good and it's so beautiful. And then the room is filled with parents that are working so hard to pay for the lessons and to drive them. Some families drive over an hour every Saturday to come to rehearsals. These kids, like my son, who needs so much sleep, gets up at 7 o'clock on Saturday morning to go play with this youth orchestra. And so that I get so emotional because I think about that. And then I think about where it's going to take them in life. And even if they don't continue playing, like how important it is for their brain development right now. And I really loved, you know, reading more about that and in your book, and I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that experience for kids, even if it's not like a regimented practice of music, but just the experience of music for kids and their future outcomes.
Yeah, I was thinking on which way to go. Dad, do you want to go
Yeah,
ahead?
let me start. I guess as an educator, as a teacher, principal, superintendent, and in the question you talked about music education, and in our book we actually pulled some punches, which I no longer I would have rewritten this part of the book a little bit more deliberately. And so over here is your experience, and Sarah could talk about that in a second. But over here, you know, we could watch those of you who are not seeing this, is the larger expanse of the population who doesn't get what your kids are getting, Hannah, or what Sarah's kids are getting.
Yeah, I didn't.
And
Yeah.
yeah, so I don't know what the numbers are, Sarah. Maybe we're up to 97% of the families don't listen to classical music And when we talk about music education, it is a lost opportunity in schools for children and families because we call it music education and create this kind of iconoclastic moment. You know, it's this narrow. Sit a certain way, stand a certain way, hold your music a certain way. And we ignore the tremendous possibilities of connecting kids to the work they do every day, whether it's English class or social studies. Or science. Can you imagine studying science in the way Sarah just talked about music in the brain? Can you imagine talking about social studies in the large thread of music for every single president? One of the folks who wrote an introduction or a blurb at the back of her book is Doris Kearns Goodwin, and she writes about her boys, her presidents, and a great historian. But when Sarah asked her about music and the president, she said, "I never really thought deeply about that." She did, and Sarah and I, we did some research about it. And so, like, even the song Amazing Grace, which goes back to the 1850s, George Washington knew Amazing Grace, and it comes up to the present day. We never knew that. Can you imagine bringing Amazing Grace or studying Marian Anderson in 1939, standing on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, singing because the Daughters of the American Revolution wouldn't let her into Constitution Hall to sing. And so music is there. Sarah said before, it's a part of our brain, it's separate. And you've talked about the whole brain. And yet we don't make it part of the whole school, the whole education. And think then about English class. Sarah's husband is a Shakespeare scholar, very well accomplished. And when I was an English major, I never knew. I read the words, but I didn't know how vibrant the music was of Shakespeare. I mean, it's full of lyrical, beautiful music that would have helped me learn Shakespeare. But it's not just Shakespeare, it's throughout. And so when you talk about music education, I talk about education with music.
I
It's
love it.
very different. Sarah, in her book, again, toned it down. But part of it was about what classical musicians and the teaching of classical music has done to separate us versus what Mozart was hoping for. Sarah, take it.
So many things I want to touch on with this. Since you left it with Mozart, I'll pick up where you just left off, but then I'm going to go back to Hannah to your original question. So Mozart wrote music during a time when performances were not the way we experience classical music today. If we have letters that Mozart wrote where he said he had the symphony, the violins had this crescendo, and the audience cheered just like I knew they would. And it was a social outing to go to performances. And also, the way we think of these symphonies now, three movements long, you can't clap between them, the person's gonna glare at you next to it. That wasn't the case. And not only that, oftentimes symphonies were separated. Here was a movement here, then there was an aria, and then there was a cello piece, that it wasn't this cognified piece of music that has to be played from beginning to end with no commentary, no clapping. God forbid you clap in the middle of a movement. And that it was a way of expressing when you really liked something or when you didn't. And the composers and performers knew that was expected. If we fast forward to the 19, I want to say it was 1912, 1914, around there, where we had the premiere of The Rite of Spring in Paris, and there was a riot because the music was seen as so raucous and bawdy for the time. The historians don't even know what's real and not real, except that it was a really big event. And there's these accounts of the chairs being pulled out of the theater because the ballet russe was wearing these really scanty costumes, and people just had these visceral reactions to it. And I mean, imagine a classical music concert today where that happened, you'd get kicked out. And it was really a form of expression. And it's just pivoted, I think, in a way that some people see as a form of respect for the musicians and for the hard work that they put behind it. But at the same time, it's taken away this accessibility to people that not everyone can sit still for 15 minutes, 20 movements. A Schubert symphony, you have over 40 minutes that you have to be quiet. And it does a disservice to making it accessible to everybody.
I'm so glad that you're saying that because I was thinking, I have a really hard time in those concerts not cheering in the middle of it, and then people are always embarrassed if they clap before the before the conductor puts their hands down, and it's like, wait, where did these rules come from? Why are and
It's
then
like
I
came
get
from Richard
smacked like,
Wagner
oh well,
back.
Wagner, come on, because we were at a jazz concert recently. I thought, oh, this is so much better because I'm not going to get in trouble if I cheer, before the conductor puts his or her hands down.
It's just a short little aside with Wagner is that he took everything in the late 1800s, and this is more than when music went from classical to romantic and a little bit more late romantic, and with his operas, which are really long. And he built his concert halls, and it was the first time we also saw a pit orchestra. So Wagner is why we have pit orchestras. So you couldn't see the performers, and it was supposed to all be centered on the vocalists. And once the lights were down, though, you also were not really allowed to leave, that you were there and you were in it. And the ring cycle from Wagner, those are hours and hours long. So good luck. Like you had to sit there. But it became this idea where he wanted it. In some ways, it's interesting because he wanted it to be a complete experience from the architecture to once you walked in to having it be this masterpiece, this great, great work. But then we lost that element that I think is so important and why I believe in these interactive concerts for children of breaking down that fourth wall. It creates this barrier and it creates this emotional block then from the audience to the performer. And so you're experiencing it, but it's different than connecting with the people on stage in a different way. Can I go back to the music education bit?
Yeah, please do.
Dad, I know you wanted to say something as well. Do you?
Oh, sure. No, you hit it. It's the fourth wall concept. I bet you,
Yeah.
Hannah, when you go to concerts, you love the breaking down. It's not stopping at the proscenium, right? It's coming out in the conductor or the band, whatever it is, they
Yeah.
engage you. And so there's
Yeah.
place for that quiet music, and there is a larger role for the connection with the audience. And I think Sarah explained it beautifully just now. This that fourth wall, the Mozart for Munchkins does that better than any organization that I've seen.
This idea that you mentioned about music education, I think is, or as my father said, education with music, I think is really important. As a classical pianist, I struggle all the time with my own children and how to integrate music into their lives. I want them to love it. That is different than what I anticipated. They don't love it the same way that I did. They don't want to sit down and practice piano for hours. My parents never asked me to practice, rarely asked me to practice. I'll rephrase that. And they always said that was a very deliberate decision on their part. And I just loved it. And so it was something that I did. And so when I think of music education and your children, sounds like they really love playing, which I think is so important. But I don't believe in pushing an instrument on a child if it's not something that brings them joy. I think try it out. And also it's about finding the right teacher. If it's not working, maybe pivot. Maybe it's a different instrument. Maybe it's another way of approaching how to learn that instrument. But then also recognizing that there are millions of children out there that don't have those opportunities. So how can we again use music paired with mindful action to get those same brain benefits out of that kid that is able to sit there and practice cello or piano or trumpet, whatever it might be, because I believe those benefits are still there for the child that can listen to music by purposefully passive listening, by active listening, and by learning how to select music as cues in their everyday lives. And that's what we really try to do with this research. Well, this person is learning, logic and problem solving because they're figuring out how to put their hands together. Well, let's listen to music and figure out if we're still listening to a piece of Mozart, which is so mathematical, that child is still getting benefits of that same logic and problem solving that that kid trying to play Mozart is, and maybe it's not exactly the same, but it would be a disservice to say that that child is not as well off as that child that is trying to play that music.
Yeah, yep.
Music predates language. So if we go back to the Neanderthals, music was a form of communication before we had formed words to communicate with people. So again, when we think about how innate music is in all of us, it's there. It's our way of communicating, again, when we don't have words, and it's been there since the Neanderthals. And so we can't do that a disservice. And we've seen research with infants that are exposed to music with a pattern, and they've done brainwave research, and that our brains are so formed in terms of what we anticipate from music. If there's music with a certain beat, I'm moving my finger, people listening can't see this, but the brain waves are pretty consistent and symmetrical. And then all of a sudden, what the researchers did is they changed it from what was anticipated of the beat to something else. And the brain wave spiked and the pattern broke, because even an infant knows what to anticipate from music. So again, when we talk about that mathematical tie to music that helps with logic, it's there, it's already there. And so it's nurturing that through listening, because we see that infants even have that. So how do we use that?
Yeah, fascinating.
Hannah and Sarah, I'm making a note here about a whole other frame. I'm changing the name of playlist, because Hannah goes, to your point, play almost infers you've got to sit down and play, right? But it should be more music for everybody list, right? It's that listening list. And when we fall into this trap, and we don't want anybody to believe our book is about making sure everybody plays an instrument, it is not that. It is about using music and as a mindful action, everything that Sarah said so beautifully before. And I think this idea of breaking the feedback loop of the familiar goes along with not a playlist, but an understanding of music and what it could do for you beyond that instrument. It's wonderful your children play music. I couldn't learn to play an instrument. I took piano, drum, and clarinet lessons, and I can't memorize. I just have a learning disability. I can't do it. And when I see Sarah sit down and play music, 10 pages of these little tiny black spots all over the paper, I say, how does she memorize that? How does she do it? For her, it works.
Yeah.
For me, I love music, but it works a very different way.
When you're sad or frustrated, what music do you go to?
I'm gonna answer first and let Sarah do the wrap up, because this is the concept of the QR codes that are in the book for every chapter, for every section, every time we mention a song. We convinced our publisher to let us use QR codes.
So cool.
So you could read the book and listen to the music by going to our website. At the same time, we also have a section, like we just did a playlist for Mother's Day where people contributed. And we're going to do end of the year playlist for teachers, although I got to work on that word playlist. So we're going to work or something for Father's Day. So the idea for me is I don't go to one piece of music for whatever the moment is. I go to lots of different music, and I love learning. Sometimes I ask Sarah, you know, it's like, you know, what is she listening to? Because it helps me figure out what I might be listening to. And so my all-time favorite song, but not my go-to song, is The Boxer by Simon and Garfunkel. I am just a poor boy, my story seldom told.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
And I love the lyrical nature of that song. And then it's interesting, the backstory is, I think it's la-la-la, because they couldn't figure out what words to put in there. So they just
they
put
those
in as a placeholder. I love the stories of music. As it's like, I read the sports page every morning, and I don't give a hoot about sports, by the way, but I love the backstories. And for me, music fills my life with stories.
Do you ever listen to Song Exploder? The podcast Song Exploder.
No,
oh, it's really cool. They take a song, and then the person who wrote it or produced it, or maybe both, and then they talk about the story behind the song. It's a really cool podcast, and the episodes are not that long, maybe 20, 25 minutes.
Thank you. I'm going to listen to it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah. And I love it, because I'll just pick a random episode, and then I hear some, I don't know, some artist I've never even heard of, a song I've never even heard of, or a song by an artist that I know that I've never heard. So yeah, it's very cool. What about you, Sarah?
Sarah, what do you do when you research?
I will answer it two different ways, as I feel like I've done a lot to you today.
That's great. I love it.
But But also because I think it depends on the mood that you want to shift to. So again, intentionally using that, if I want to feel kind of nostalgic, if I'm in a bad mood, but I want to, get out of it, but I don't want to be hyped up, I'll often go to the Beatles. Or if I'm feeling anxious, I'll go to Bach cello suites. That's just my default. I've created so many attachments, and it has to be Yo-Yo Ma. I've listened to other cellists, and it actually does not do the same thing for me. And when I discovered that, I was actually mad. I was like, why? Why is this bothering me so much? And I think that's interesting. And again, what my father mentioned with that shake it off and shaking it up, because I am very stuck in that feedback of the familiar of what that attachment does to me. So I think for nostalgia, it does definitely something like the Beatles, and it helps pull me out. I have so many memories listening to countless Beatles songs or Simon and Garfunkel with my parents. But if I want something more of a motivator to really get it out, I like to run. And I listen to a lot of pop music when I run, Chappell Roan,
Yeah,
which
great.
my kids and I listen to. And then I realized the other day how inappropriate some of the lyrics are. And my kids are there singing along, not knowing what they're singing. I said, probably should shift some of this.
One point, they'll be like, "Hey, wait."
What does this mean, Mom? I have a few years, hopefully, till I get there. Or some Dua Lipa, but something with a lot of beats. And again, it's because I associate it with running, which makes me feel good, but also it just has the high beats per minute. And so I think it's really, it depends on my mood, but I do consciously shift for that boost, whatever boost it is that I want.
And that is our show for today. Thank you for taking time out of your day to listen. My takeaway from this episode is that music truly is about love. Love for ourselves and our experience as a human in this world. Love for our families, love for our communities, love for learning new things. I am truly grateful to Sarah and Mort for writing this beautiful book. I hope you all get a chance to read it, or at least take a moment to check out their website, which you can find in the show notes. Thank you for helping us spread the word about executive function skills. People need to hear it. We appreciate you sharing Focus Forward with your friends and your colleagues. Word of mouth keeps us on the air, and we just appreciate it so much. And don't forget to rate us wherever you listen. And if you leave a written review on Apple Podcasts, it makes a big difference because somehow it makes it easier for people to find us. I don't understand the algorithm, but I do know that a written review makes a big difference. So if you have a second, hop on over there and take care of that. Thank you. You can sign up for our subscriber email at beyondbooksmart.com/podcast. And a million thanks to Sean Potts, my editor and producer and friend, and to Ellen Galinsky for connecting me with Sarah and Mort Sherman. Thanks for listening.